thank you very much, and thanks for coming. So this is a bit of an old project, something I started a few years ago, but it's one of those that has been on the back burner, and now I'm really going to try and write a book on it. So it's really good to try and revive it and hear your thoughts and opinions. So looking forward to hearing your thoughts. So by the time the contraceptive pill was introduced in 1960, Britain was home to a booming trade in mechanical and chemical contraceptives. So what had been a small underground network of individual sellers of French letters during the early 19th century had become a relatively small but profitable industry. An industry that offered consumers rubber sheets, caps and pessaries from chemist shops, vending machines, birth control clinics and via mail order. Obviously the history of contraception and sex more broadly is a very popular topic among historians. I won't go into the details of the historiography here, but histories of 19th and 20th century birth control tended to neglect, really, the commercial and the buying and selling of these things, and have focused on things like national and international demographics, so we've looked at fertility, female sexual emancipation, the role of kind of technologies in emancipating female in sexual decisions, looking at changing family sizes and dynamics, and also thinking about the role of condoms and things in social controversies and social reform. The only, the best and the most detailed study is John Peel's Manufacture and Retailing of Contraceptives in England from 1963. So that's kind of tells you that it really does need to be updated and broadened. And I would argue that such neglect of this this perspective is due to the fact that scholars have been preoccupied by the same sorts of questions, and that's primarily how effective these methods were in controlling fertility in relation to other methods, and so how they affect fertility rates, family sizes, particularly in Britain as the kind of first industrial nation. But actually, I'm not interested in their effectiveness. What I'm interested in is how the market affected the visibility and the kind of buying and selling cultures at this time. So if we look at actual significance in time in terms of quantitatively significant, they're actually not that significant. So figures available on uptake at this time vary, but one often cited study suggests that only 9% of the middle classes used sheaths by 1930, while another reported that only 18% of the whole British population used any form of mechanical birth control in 1949. So the reliability of these figures is of course questionable, given the difficulty in obtaining data on this rather kind of elusive and embarrassing topic, and obviously consumers are not likely to record their thoughts on these products. But even if they are representative, they still indicate a degree of demand, and I would argue that this degree requires further studies. In fact, there are recent studies on this kind of commercial aspects in Depression-era America and also Nazi Germany, but so far not much on Britain. So really, the aim of my project is to uncover the significance of contraceptives as commodities during this period and think about how and why consumer opinion of them varied according to different kind of variables, age, gender, class, locality, and across the period. Obviously, consumer views on this is quite difficult, but I suggest that it may be possible to outline further responses to them by paying greater attention to the industrial structures that are developing in this period and the responses of these structures to consumer needs. So it's important actually to note that this was an industry that didn't just exist on its own, but fed into a wider 19th and 20th century industry for medical household goods more broadly. So just to break down what I want to talk about today, I want to look first at the kind of cyclical structure of the commercial industry. So think about production, then think about promotion, then think about distribution and retail. And does an analysis of the trade in these areas help us to uncover those kind of hidden consumer responses? So just to start with production, As historians of medical commerce have recognised, the late 19th century rise in the mass production of household medical goods, so these range from hot water bottles, ice caps, hernia belts, feeding bottle teats, largely made out of rubber, they signal not only manufacturers' ability to produce these goods in higher quantities than in previous periods, but is also indicative of an emergence of a new medical consumer culture. The middle classes in Britain in particular were eager consumers of new medical remedies, technologies for use in the home, and produced mass and consumed mass-produced rubber goods, which found a place in their newly fitted bathrooms. So the kind of emergence of medical goods coincided with this rise in fitted middle-class bathrooms and this, you know, need for kind of toilet paper, toothbrushes, these kinds of things that weren't necessarily within the home beforehand. Late 19th century markets for contraceptives, so there was a seamless enema, a vaginal douche which produced out of one rubber sheet, made it more durable and comfortable for the user, apparently. And they were certainly considerably smaller than for other goods like hot water bottles, but nonetheless, it's clear that contraceptive consumption, if you look from this perspective, was larger than we thought. And following from the 19th century development of the vulcanisation process of rubber, the number of companies producing contraceptives grew rapidly. It's actually Dalston in East London became the British hub of rubber good manufacture and became known as the London Indian Rubber Works. But there were also industrial centres in cities like Birmingham, Leeds, Manchester, and so on. Manufacturers clustered in an area to kind of invest in production alongside other rubber goods intended for household consumption. Lambert & Co., which were a famous one from Dalston, evidently improved the moulding of synthetic rubber, producing this seamless enema, and influenced the manufacturing techniques of other companies like G. Franklin. I'm trying to get lots of plans of production works in Dalston, and this is the only one I've been able to find. And this is G.J. Franklin, it's from 1944, so it's quite late, but it gives you a sense of how production took place. And also at this time, there were new trade journals, such as the India Rubber World and Rubber Age, which I'm sure are thrilling publications. And they allowed producers across the world to share expertise and knowledge about target markets and production methods. It's interesting to note that while these industrial hubs were growing, actually the majority of sheaths that were sold in the UK were still imported from Germany until the 1930s. Lambert's and Son, however, continued to manufacture between half and a quarter of a million of sheaths per year as early as 1890. And by the late 1930s, a time when historians acknowledged that contraceptive availability was becoming more spread, one firm in Dalston reportedly produces 8.5 million contraceptive appliances per year, and another said that they produced 72,000 per week. So, the introduction of latex during the 1930s improved the quality of British contraceptives and reduced production costs. But unsurprisingly, the outbreak of the Second World War and the resulting cessation of trade with Germany had a big impact on the contraceptive market, resulting in shortages of sheaths and raised prices. But by the 1950s, a company called the London Rubber Company, who had been producing around Dalston since 1929, became the UK's principal producer of sheaths, but also its principal producer of things like rubber gloves and balloons. You might recognise this company as one of its brand names, which is Durex. So they emerged in 1929 as the London Rubber Company. Companies, contraceptives produced from these manufacturing hubs were distributed nationwide, but closer analysis of the way in which these hubs operated is also revealing of how they helped to shape local consumption of these products. So there's quite a few neglected reports that were commissioned for a proposed contraceptive regulation bill of 1939, which was supposed to kind of limit the what they saw as the overt promotion of these goods at the time, although it never passed, reveal that the sale of both birth control devices and associated literature was actually commonly read, and knowledge around about contraception was very common in manufactories that produced them, unsurprisingly. And certainly, if you look at fertility rates in some localities where some of these hubs were established, there's some correlation. Simon Schretter has described these as kind of communication communities where sexual knowledge is shared in informal workplaces. Okay, so just moving on to promotion and print culture. So it's important to note, obviously, that consumer demand for contraceptives was also fueled by a variety of different promotional literature. It's not to say in this period that advertising of these products is new, but printed media became much more widely distributed and took different forms, particularly in London, in a precedented scale, and also appeared in newspapers, cheap penny weeklies, and as trade catalogues produced in their thousands. So this is one of my favourites, that contraceptive advertisements began to appear twice, sometimes four or five times in the same paper. This is the Illustrated Police News from 1897. So the Illustrated Police News was a kind of cheap, titillating penny weekly that advertises at the bottom here, W. George Rubber Preventives for 5 and 6 from Holywell Street, the Strand, alongside Spicy Books, A Book for Ladies, Those About to Marry. So it's kind of salacious in these cheap penny weeklies. So between 1914 and 1938, not less than 15 million books, pamphlets and brochures furnishing kind of practical contraceptive devices were circulated. And we don't know how much exactly was produced, but it seems to have been in quite significant numbers than has been previously recognised. Catalogues in particular became a regular output of 19th century department stores, retailers and wholesalers, and they could develop impersonal relationships with consumers over vast distances. So you could read about this from the comfort of your own home, for example, rather than, you know, going out and seeing it in the street. What's interesting about these covers is that they were disguising their true nature, what they were really about. So they were called a list of surgical appliances. Nothing really surgical in there, but this disguising term, for anyone that knew what that meant. And also very plain covers with nothing written on at all. So just to ensure that, you know, if these was delivered and they reached the wrong address, that they did not attract unwarranted attention from neighbours, etc. And inside the catalogues, condoms were also discreetly disguised as buttonholes, sweet wrappers, cigarette papers, and things like that. So this is from an advertising catalogue in 1912. So this suggests that, you know, companies were aware of the sensitivity that they needed to promote these products to consumers. There's a 1936 catalogue from the Brasier Surgical Manufacturing Company that stated about their cigarette cases that it was a heavily nickeled and smartly decorated cigarette case containing four circular seamless preventatives of first-class quality made up in the form of a cigarette. Detection is impossible, so well are they imitated and concealed. But simultaneously, companies incorporated promotional techniques designed to increase sales and differentiate their products, so including testimonials from prominent authorities, Mary Stopes being a famous one, and also medical rhetoric, branding, trade names like the Malthusian was a common one, linked to kind of the Malthusian League, and also Durex comes around at this time as a trade name for the London Rubber Company's sheaths. Lambert, this is some soluble pessaries. The Lambutt was one of their brand names for the improved oral syringe, the injection of olive oil and quinine. So what's also interesting about these catalogues is that there's a wide variety in quality and price of the products promoted, suggesting a variety of consumers of both genders. So I suggest that this challenges studies that only point to the middle class married woman as the sole consumer of things like pessaries and the middle class married or unmarried man as the sole consumer of condoms. In fact, it seems that catalogue producers have more actively targeted those on lower incomes. So companies began to increase, for example, increasingly promote a condom called the poor man's friend, a sheath that targeted males on quite low incomes. And so it's this awareness that, you know, condoms can be quite expensive, so they'll promote those that are really quite cheap. Walton Rubber Good Company also demonstrates that condoms were promoted to women as well. So condoms could be disguised and placed in ladies' cosmetic powders well into the 1940s. So women are reportedly, another report from this contraceptive regulation bill suggests that lots of women like to carry those in their handbag and keep them on their bedroom dressers. Another interesting finding from looking at lots of these catalogues is that they often took on the form of birth control advice literature published by social reformers and or doctors and replicated the language so to emphasise the scientific methods of birth control. So this is a kind of rhetoric to promote their medical authority in this area. So In fact, some catalogue producers even charge for their catalogues, so you have to pay to buy this advertising as you would pay to buy a health guide. So the Stockwell Hygienic Company, so Stockwell, London, charged sixpence for their catalogue. And also some birth control literatures were little more than a gloss on the commercial catalogue. So there's a lot of interplay between what was a catalogue, what was actually considered reference literature on this topic. The most famous example is Henry Arthur Albert's The Wife's Handbook. So he was a doctor in Leeds and was struck off the medical register for overtly promoting different products within his advice literature to married women. This book talks about pregnancy, what to do with babies and everything like that, but it also contains his own products. So he used this this book to make a profit, essentially, on his own birth control products, and he got struck off for doing so. Having said that, though, it's one of the most popular birth control literatures of the time, and we went into about 50, 60 different editions. Okay, just moving on from catalogues and promotion and thinking about distributors. There's a wide range of distribution methods of contraceptives in this period, and actually, like catalogues, we don't really know much about them. Birth control clinics, those that were run by the Family Planning Association, actually used quite aggressive, the companies who supplied them actually used quite aggressive methods to secure orders, and we know more about that than we do other methods. And that's suggestive of the value of the market of clinics. Yet we don't really know how the extent to which they're available on the high street, through chemists, etc. And in fact, the high street in this period has become an increasingly important site for consumers to buy, coming back to again this growth in medical consumer goods. Yet we don't really know how contraceptives form part of this story. Historians have tended to say that these products were inaccessible, they were hidden behind shop counters, in shop drawers, meaning that you had to have the knowledge and, you know, the nudge, nudge, wink, wink for you to get these products. Something for the weekend, sir, when you go to a barber's, that kind of thing. However, if we look more closely at retail outlets, particularly in the 20th century and in the south of England, we can see that the importance of retailers in developing a new visual culture of contraceptives in urban places. So while it is true that the kind of display of these objects remained controversial, department stores such as the Army and Navy from 1872 sold enemas, caps and douches to female middle class consumers already eager to consume other household goods. And by the 1930s, sheaths were openly available from garages, public parks, public houses, hygiene and chemist shops, as well as more long-standing distribution points as the barber and the tobacconist. So it was the rise of the retail chemist, in fact, that becomes distinct from the pharmaceutical chemist that made this the most impact on the availability on the high street. As particularly is that they retail chemists tried to shape themselves as this one-stop shop for all kind of medicines for the whole family. Contraceptives gradually in retail chemists came from being hidden under the counter to be more prominently displayed as, again, sanitary domestic appliances. By the 1930s, it was increasingly obvious that chemists were responding to consumer demands and were abiding by professional marketing literature advising them to put rubber goods with toilet articles, cameras, sick room equipment, all that stuff that we are used to chemists selling today. One 1938 report reveals that only 7 out of 280 chemists in one district of London did not visibly stock contraceptives. In another London district, 40 chemist shops were supplemented by 34 specialist birth control shops. So the specialist kind of birth control shops were increasingly popular outlet, which allowed householders to purchase goods without consulting medical professionals. But again, they were disguised, and we have things like the Stockwell Hygienic Company. This is their shop, and in Stockwell. And Curtis's surgical store, the surgical rubber goods store, and that's in Birmingham. So again, to hide or to stop, reduce consumer embarrassment by going into these things. And there were also separate men's and ladies' entrances as well, so you could talk to a male or female employee if you wished. This kind of comes from an older barbershop tradition. These separate entrances. Beyond London, reports suggest that female birth control appliances were displayed on the counters of chemist shops in textile manufacturing working class districts of Lancashire as early as 1900. So areas in which wages could be as much as 15% above the national average. And chemist shop in York, reports say you could barely miss seeing them. Some stores and retail chemists like the Stockwell Hygienic Company had lots of different branches across the country in Brighton, Bradford, Manchester, Hereford, and of course these companies also produced and distributed catalogues. And certainly by the 1940s, the London Rubber Company, which was becoming this very kind of monopolistic and aggressive company, they claimed to supply pessaries and Durex to not only London-based retailers, but over 10,000 chemists nationwide. And it's partly because they started to undercut other companies, offering retailers special discounts, and that they became quite as big as they did. Chemists took seriously not only the ways these products were displayed inside, but also outside in their windows. So you can see here, there's quite a packed out window display. The whole point of this is kind of put as many things in as possible, and therefore you will attract attention. That's kind of the rhetoric of the time. Shop and window display was not simply a way of enticing and inciting customers in, but also contained messages about the value, the quality, the origin of the products. And it was a response to attitudes about consumption and the problematic nature of these medical commodities, and also consumer concerns about reliability, trustworthiness, and kind of honesty of the company. By the 1930s, retailers claimed to tactfully display contraceptives in their window, quote, in a manner that cannot offend the most sensitive or fastidious person. So here's another one. Soho is not a great example, but it's the only picture that I've got because Soho was so overtly kind of sexual in this time anyway. But it is interesting that this shop does claim to be a birth control specialist, and Dameroids is a kind of chemical contraceptive of the time. And of course, this married love by Mary Stokes, Wisdom for Wives, again, the birth control literature is sold alongside the products. A crucial part of the displays was also colourful and highly decorative show cards, banners, posters, written descriptions, because without them, they were, quote, they themselves are extremely dull-looking things and they would not attract the attention of anybody more than once. Several birth control shops also began investing in illuminated signs, which were a bit too much for some of the local authorities, and they were asked to remove them. There was a lot of vocal opposition to some of these displays in certain urban areas, but they were also successful in informing consumers and encouraging contraceptive consumption. There's quite a lot of evidence of this contained in the archives of the Public Morality Council, which in this period seemed to debate what's appropriate and what's not appropriate contraceptive window display advertising, which makes for fascinating reading. But it suggests that such displays they were fearful that it would encourage consumption not only from married men and women, but also the unmarried and the adolescents, which are two kind of danger audiences for the Public Morality Council. Unmarried adolescents could be large passers-by who relied on these kinds of window displays to present them with sufficient information on birth control appliances that were less easy for them to access elsewhere. Adolescents in the middle and working classes had long been wage earners by the 1930s, and retail chemists sought to take advantage of their disposable income. The seeming success in this in encouraging adolescents, those who had typically less knowledge about birth control appliances, is suggested by another report by the Public Morality Council, suggesting that 300 young unmarried men and women had inspected the display between 6 and 8 p.m. Of one shop, and 35 had entered the shop to purchase goods. So along with their attractive nature, the success of these window displays lay in the fact that they prevented consumer embarrassment by allowing them to kind of point out what they wanted to the shop assistant rather than asking for it by name. And crucially, the methods of purchasing were becoming increasingly unregulated and unmonitored. Which brings me on to the next method, which is vending machines and the development of vending machines and their establishment in public places all over England and Wales from the late 1920s. This is an extension of this unmonitored purchasing method that began with window displays. And consumers of any type were thus completely free to obtain sheaves from machines that were the married and the respectable, as well as the young and unmarried. They were available at any time outside normal working hours. Oh, I forgot this interesting slide describes what was in the display of one window in Cambridge Circus in the 1930s. So it's quite interesting to see the list of the different types of product that were in a display. So they just kind of piled them high, really, just to attract as much attention. So some people might be interested in the Pro Race sheaths, or Patterson's female pills, or the combination of the Bessarine sheath called the Poor Man's Friend. Over 160 vending machines selling the London Rubber Company's Onar sheaths were placed all over London between 1929 and 1949. Again, kind of suggesting how the London Rubber Company became this quite aggressive supplier of contraceptive goods. They were placed outside chemist shops, in barber and hairdresser shops, at garages, in pubs, and in new sites of leisure activity common among adolescents, such as the cinema, the dance hall, the amusement and the shopping arcade. So here are some examples from 1932. The Belgrave Pharmacy is in Leicester. So take what you want for six or one. And you can see more closely outside this chemist shop in the middle, and there's a close-up on the left of how the surgical wear, rubber wear, the condom machine is right outside the chemist. The Belgrave Pharmacy one's on the corner of a street. These condoms were priced between 1 shilling and 2 shillings 6 pence. 3 were sold in machines alongside things like razors, aspirin, cough lozenges and cigarettes. And while it is absolutely almost impossible really to establish how many were sold from these machines, it was clear that the levels of trade were high enough to warrant extensive study and the commissioning of various reports on them. One report suggested that children, girls and boys that were not yet in their teens, purchased shoes from such machines because they were attracted to the kind of bright colours of the machine and the bold lettering and the branding, and that they didn't necessarily know what they were, but they bought them anyway and started playing around with them, and this couldn't happen because it was obviously going to lead to trouble. So they were considered quite salacious by a lot of social reformers. While the Ministry of Supply were keen to kind of encourage further expansion of these machines, the adoption of a bylaw prohibiting sales from slot machines by 90% of local authorities by 1951 meant that they disappeared by 1952-53, and they didn't really surface again. But what's interesting is if you go to Spain, Holland, France, Germany, you will see some vending machines selling condoms outside chemist shops because they never adopted this bylaw. But what's interesting in British history is it happens between 1929 to 1952-53, so that's a really interesting period. And by the time the contraceptive pill had been introduced, these machines kind of spring up again, but in public toilets and toilets in public houses, and which is where we kind of associate them with today. And by the introduction of the pill, contraceptive suppliers have succeeded in supplying consumers and other with many varied birth products, and no fewer than 100 million Durex sheaths, 95% of which the condoms on the market by 1960 were supplied by the London Rubber Company. By 1974, there were more than 200 brand names of condoms on the market, but it's Durex that kind of gets taken to task by the Monopolies and Mergers Commission several times for being overtly aggressive in this area. Okay, so just to conclude, I'm really proposing that we take a new look at contraception and birth control appliances and apply a market-led approach, one which kind of combines methodologies from history of technology, business history, and also the history of the book to explore the cycle, the chain in the life of a contraceptive product from producer to promoter to distributor and then to consumer and then back again, and how do consumer responses feed back into production. I would argue that a wide-scale prevalence, uncovering the wide-scale prevalence of contraceptives is possible when we shift a hot historical emphasis from one centred on morality. I think that the morality element has kind of taken over, and also demography and sexual liberation, to a new approach that takes seriously the commercialisation of these products and combines a wealth of variety of different source materials, including images and looking at the visual culture of these products. So by more fully exploring the relationship between supply and demand, I think we can uncover a deeper account of changing consumer responses to new forms of contraceptive, although, you know, this account will probably always remain incomplete. Married couples made decisions about purchasing for birth control appliances along the other many commercially manufactured medical goods that became increasingly available and paid for them with income freed up by their limited family size, while adolescents and the unmarried were tempted into chemist shops by elaborate displays and could purchase condoms from vending machines up until 1953 at least, relatively unmonitored. Thank you.